send it to you to put on the website and stuff. Because not too many people have that now. But I have to redact my dad's birth date from it before I put it anywhere online, since people unfortunately like to take the names and birth dates of people who passed away and use them, you know, and use it for stuff.
Yeah, redacting software is all over the place. I have lots of scanning software that includes it, and Photoshop, of course. But yeah, it's very easy to do that. You just have to, you have to be careful and kind of over blur it a little bit, because again, with artificial intelligence, sometimes if you just smudge it a bit that you and I think it's not legible, AI can kind of figure it out sometimes.
I'm just going to do it the old-fashioned way, snap the picture with my phone with my finger or Franny's finger over the birth date. I don't think they have X-ray software yet to go through that.
Okay, that'll do it. You know, unfortunately, there was a time that people weren't kind of aware of how things work, and they'd redact it on a document, which doesn't redact anything. It just kind of covers it up. The metadata is still there, and so they would post these things redacted with the metadata, and people would just run it through the software and strip out the redaction.
Yeah, I think the federal courts have gotten themselves in hot water doing that, no? Go ahead.
Yeah, pretty much everyone was guilty of it at the beginning. I think hopefully by now most people realize that that's a big problem and they don't redact it using, you know, or they've improved the redaction algorithm so that it doesn't, it can't be undone. The problem is the software that's a little too clever for itself. All of our software tends to be able to undo itself, and so it means that it hides the data elsewhere. So you have to be smart enough to know that when you're redacting things, you don't want to be able to recall it. So you have to program it that way, and hopefully software is doing that these days. I haven't really investigated. I tend to use software that just kind of blurs it and such, or else I'll just kind of take it into Photoshop and put a black square over it.
Interesting. One of the things I brought down. I wanted a junk. I have an old laptop, a Windows 7 laptop that kind of has solid state drive on it. Literally ran out of memory. The solid state drive isn't large enough by today's standards to. So I was going to junk it or just give it to someone to use for field day and stuff, and I realized, wait a minute, you know, there's data and stuff on it. I just can't give it to somebody without, like, reformatting the drive or, you know, or whatever. Go ahead.
Yeah, you got to be very careful. Every so often, college kids kind of get a couple of used computers, and they demonstrate all the secrets that they could read. And you can't just kind of hit delete and leave it at that, because that will just delete the file allocation table. It's kind of a table of contents, and all the data is still written onto the sectors and can be manually read off of them and then reconstructed. So there's a lot of software out there that's designed to basically nuke a drive. It will not only delete it, but it will overwrite it with a series of ones and zeros. So it makes it very difficult to recover the information after that. So you should look into that. They're free. They're open source, those types of software.
Okay, very good. Yeah, maybe I'll do that. The thing is, it's like completely out of memory, so not sure how easy it's going to be to put the software on it to do that. But, yeah, I'll probably do that at some point because I do want to get it out of the house and maybe let, as I said, let somebody use it for field day or parks on the air or whatever. It's probably, I mean, it's totally obsolete for any real work, but, you know, as a field day computer, as a POTA computer, logging computer, whatever, it's probably just fine. Anyway, you know, it's probably time to move on with the net, and I'm going to go do some other things so I can be back for the SpaceNet report. So sounds great for now, Roy, and thanks very much for the tips. I'll look into the 3M command stuff because it sounds like something that will do the job for me. WB2BX, so.
AC2GS, 73, Frank, thanks as always for participating. And you could load that software on a thumb drive and just run it through the thumb drive. You don't even have to install it into whatever your hard drive or whatever is. It's just loaded into as a portable on a thumb drive, stick the thumb drive in, and run the software and nuke the whole thing.
Okay, very good. Again, do you remember what to look for?
I don't remember. It might be called Nuke. If you just type in Nuke old hard drive, I'm sure it'll come up with a couple of decent open source that have been used for at least 10, 15 years. It doesn't really require too much in the way of sophistication. It's just something that does a serial high security. It gives you a list of different types. You know, if you want the CIA protocol, or if you want the FBI protocol, or what have you. So just type into your browser in Google Nuke old hard drive, and you'll come up with it.
Comment?
Sure.
Did I make sure I had it? SKC2SHO. Yeah, so I don't know. I only caught part of that, so I don't know if it's been said, but that does not work for solid-state drives. There is zero security if you do it that way. If you have a solid-state drive, you must use the manufacturer's secure erase tool. Copy that?
Okay. I was unaware of that. I would imagine, well, what's kind of the problem? I mean, basically that software writes ones and zeros. So you're saying it's not writing ones and zeros to a solid-state drive?
No, it's not that you're not writing the ones and zeros. It's that the previous data is still recoverable. The manufacturer's tool will actually raise the voltage to a state higher than what a one would write, I guess if it's one. And then it also shorts it back to a zero state. So it has to go high and then low, and I think that's higher than what the standard voltage would be for each of those bits. So, yeah, look it up. You'll see. There's lots written about it. You must use a manufacturer's tool for a solid-state drive.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, John. I learned something new today. I'll have to look further into it. I haven't had need to nuke a solid-state drive yet. I'm still using all of mine, so I haven't really had that problem. So the only ones I've nuked have been good old, disk drives and such. So thank you. Thank you. I'll have to look further into that, John.
Yeah, thanks. I had to line up here to the computer to get my comment in. I still don't have my receiver replaced yet. Anyway, good hearing the net, guys. Back to you, Roy. ACTGSMC2SHO.
Ah, you're welcome. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you caught early on For some reason, every so often, my computer has problems doing All-Star. So today I kind of tried to get on, and it was just a bunch of noise. And so I'm operating RF, so people are hearing me being noisier than I usually am, since I'm down here in the south of Brooklyn, which is really far away from Glen Oaks.
Yeah, I got a question, Roy.
Sure.
Yeah, John, let me just make sure I understand. If I use the manufacturer's software, it's a Dell machine, so I assume I could get the software from Dell. That would render the machine brain dead, so that anybody I gave it to or sold it to that would want to use the machine for, say, field day or portal logging would have to totally start again and load an operating system on it and then their software. Am I correct?
Yeah, so it's not Dell unless Dell manufactured the drive, which I don't think they manufacture any drives. You need to know who the manufacturer of the drive is. So it's not the it's not the computer itself, as that's just a assembly of other manufacturers' parts typically, although Dell does make their own motherboards, and maybe not directly, but anyway. So if it's Samsung or it's one of the other brands, you need to go get their tool, their secure erase tool. Absolutely. And I'm going to post a link right now to the chat that's a really good article about it.
Very good. If you're able to get to Device Manager, Frank, you could probably figure out what model solid-state drive it operates. Otherwise, you may have to crack the case to take a peek underneath to see who the manufacturer. It's usually manufactured by companies that make memory chips to begin with. They are usually very commonly the guys who manufacture the solid-state drives.
ADQDU?
Yes, Alex?
Just something's wrong with the Glen Oaks repeater, I think, or something's getting transmitted. It's like computerish static coming over the line. I'm talking to you on EchoLink right now. Over.
Oh, okay. That's odd because I'm listening to, I'm actually for the first time in a long while doing it RF. So I'm listening to Glen Oaks. I'm not hearing that.
For me, it looks like somebody's having a carrier on and scratching the microphone. That's how it sounds.
Oh, okay. So, they could be playing that under me or something. I don't know. When I'm listening, I don't hear that artifact. So, I don't think the repeater is the problem. I think one of our listeners is a problem.
Yeah, Roy, all I'm hearing through EchoLink is just some fried eggs on your signal. So it's just the RF path. I don't think it has anything to do with, my guess anyway, I don't think it has anything to do with anything going on EchoLink or somebody else transmitting or anything. Anyway, I'm going to be listening. WB2BXL. Thank you very much for all the info.
You're welcome, Frank. 73, be well. We'll talk to you down the line. Craig, are you still with us? We'll try one more time. Craig, are you out there? Okay, I guess he's gone someplace else to do something else. Wesley, what's your subjects for tonight?
Okay, I have only one. So, it's going to sound weird, unbelievable. It's going to sound... I'm going to make a lot of claims. but they're not my claims, so don't catch me on the words. And if it's true, in the history of human animals, there was never such a thing. If it's not true, it's not true. Okay, so imagine that you have an engine, and that engine has two versions. One requires the fuel, one doesn't require the fuel. Let me drop. That engine could be applied to heavy-duty applications, generators, or municipal generator, heavy-duty commercial vehicles, marine industry vessels, aerospace industry, like airplanes, reactive airplanes, agricultural machinery, and for this, to next page. The name of the company is Astron Aerospace, and this company is the Department of Defense contractor. They recently got joint venture with another much bigger defense contractor. Okay. Now, Astron Aerospace has shown a partial prototype of the new rotary combustion engine. It says it runs at extraordinary 60% of efficiency, burning total clean with zero nitrogen oxide emission and nothing but fresh water out of the tailpipe. With internal combustion engine on the way out of the electric vehicle, on the way in both politically and environmentally innovative ways, I'm reading, of using renewable energy for clean transportation are at the forefront of many engineering minds. Astron Aerospace has recently announced its latest novel innovative engine, H2 Starfire. Now, there are H2 Starfire and H2 Starfire with electrolyzer. H2 Starfire doesn't require, it requires a tank. Doesn't H2 Starfire with electrolyzer make the fuel on the spot and uses it? So it's a sort of one car rotary engine, but with an interesting twist. There are no planetary gears or apex seals. Instead, there are two counter rotating shafts that have incredibly tight friction-less tolerances, using ceramic coating and titanium to prevent the escape of pressure or gas and mitigate heat deformation. And the tolerances are 2,000 to 4,000 of an inch, which translates to 0.1 millimeter. Okay, now 0.1 millimeter, there is no tolerance. It's a big hole. In mechanics, 10,000 of an inch is the tolerance. 0.1 millimeter is a humongous gap, especially when we're talking about nitrogen. Engines, they are powered with anything else but regular gasoline. So, so it's not a hydrogen, it's any engine. Okay, now, I'm going to the next. hydrogen-powered combustion engine, which is H2 Starfire, and remember we have two types of it, produces water as a byproduct and emits no planet warming emissions whatsoever. Then I'm reading, H2 Starfire engine provides the ability to power the ducted fan for more efficient more efficiently and without any major disadvantages of requiring conventional Brayton cycle propulsion technology employed by modern turbine engines. So, I would say this. We have a 60% efficiency that none of the known to us combustion engines can do. And we compare it to the car that has 20% efficiency. And Dr. Ray, correct me if I'm wrong, we have a 3 times more efficiency. So with the same capacity of the tank, instead of making 400 miles, we make 1,200 miles from the same. But with the engine number 2, with electrolyzer, we don't need the tank. And I'm going to explain how it's being done. But first, Dr. Roy, please take the microphone.
AC2GS, well, two questions for you, Wesley. The first is, did you ever hear of the term shooting the messenger? So even though you didn't write the article, when you read the article, people listening can't kind of call up the author and yell at them. So unfortunately, they might yell at you. Number two question is, where the heck are you getting the hydrogen from?
The H2 Starfire engine is different from H2 Starfire without electrolyzer. Unlike H2 Starfire without electrolyzer, which requires hydrogen fuel for each cycle, the H2 Starfire engine with electrolyzer incorporates innovative technology that generates hydrogen fuel on the fly using static plasma electrolyzing during operation. This cutting-edge approach not only enhances efficiency but also establishes the H2 Starfire engine as a sustainable, eco-friendly choice for the future. And that's the end of the quote. But on the need of it, it says that's many things. So how the new H2 Starfire engine with electrolyzer solves the problem and sets new standards? Let me drop.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
It doesn't solve the problem. It just moves the problem someplace else. The question goes from where do you get the hydrogen gas to where do you get the electricity?
Okay, so my understanding, I'm not saying it as my statement. It's not my statement. So, first you have a battery, you deliver the electricity. When the system starts and starts to produce hydrogen, that is mixed with air and then is makes the combustion in the engine that doesn't have any gears. Then the battery is simply charged from the energy produced by that engine. But I'm going to read to you what it says. So H2 Starfire without electrolyzer is designed to utilize hydrogen as a fuel, but the new model of H2 Starfire engine without electrolyzer is projected to produce hydrogen on the fly. Okay, that's what they have, but they have... during the startup of H2 Starfire engine with electrolyzer, the ambient air is taken into the multi-stage two-split cycle rotary engine where it's compressed to high pressure, resulting in the temperature rise due to the heat of compression, but the temperature of the air is after final compression is not enough to attain the
hydrogen auto ignition. As high pressure hydrogen is fed initially during startup and mixed with the compressed air in the pre-chamber and passed into the combustion section where with help of spark is ignited, where hydrogen and oxygen from air react to form water in the form of steam and huge release of energy. And then there are all of the information about it. It's the temperature is only 350 degrees of Celsius. I don't know how it translates to Fahrenheit because I'm more familiar with Celsius. And it says how that is being done. Now, the interesting thing is that 38 pounds is the weight of the engine giving 190 horsepower. So 190 horsepower is 39 pounds. Compare it to the regular combustion engine. Back to you.
Well, once again, you seem to be, or this author is, violating the laws of conservation of energy. You basically have a machine that is the hydrogen engine version of the extension cord that's plugged into itself. All of these processes have a non-zero loss. So either finding some energy source and breaking it into hydrogen has a loss of some percentage, and then so you plug it into the motor and you don't factor in the efficiency of the motor, you factor in the efficiency of the original fuel that you use to power the motor. And if you're using electricity, you can't have electricity recharge its own battery. It doesn't work like that. If you use the energy of the battery to electrolyze water into hydrogen and oxygen, that's where the energy is. You can't kind of somehow losslessly recharge the battery and just keep on doing it. It doesn't work that way. Everything introduces a non-zero loss into the system.
You're absolutely right. There is no violation of the law, of any laws of physics at all. The energy from hydrogen is used as a fuel. The first starting the engine, producing the torque, and producing the first spark. The first spark actually makes the hydrogen, if you have a tank, the model number one, then the hydrogen comes from the tank. In model number two, they say the hydrogen is produced on the spot. That's what they say. And they have another big, humongous military contractor that actually decided to go into the partnership with them. Oh, I found. Maximum temperature reach is 1400 of Fahrenheit. Inside the engine temperature reach 1400 Fahrenheit at maximum, and hydrogen can burn cleanly to produce energy, noise, and mechanical vibration free. What it says, the company claims it achieved another major milestone by eliminating need for water cooling, so there is no water cooling needed. I'm not sure how much of that is true, but if we have two major military contractors doing that as a partnership, then we may expect that it has some merit, Dr. Roy.
There are AC2GS, by the way. There are loads of people who are being paid by loads of other people for stuff that will never work. So you can't, just because someone has a patent on something doesn't mean it works. Just because someone is investing in a device doesn't mean it works. More often than not, they don't work. Again, you have conservation of energy. You have every transformation of energy occurs at a loss. So in the case of the battery, you have electrochemical energy potential, which is then transferred into bond potential energy of hydrogen and an oxygen bonds being broken and having free hydrogen, which leaves you with high energy atomic bonds, and those are then sparked together to give you heat and kinetic energy. And some of the kinetic energy is just dissipated. It's not, you don't have a perfect means of containing the temperature, and ultimately your energy is lost. You can maybe recycle a little bit of it back to recharge the battery, but it would be a pittance. So effectively, again, you're stuck with how are you going to keep the battery charged. You can't keep the battery charged with the power output of the motor because that, again, assumes a zero-loss device, which doesn't exist in reality. So it's a flawed design. If you want to use it as a high-efficiency hydrogen motor, great, but you still have to figure out where to get the hydrogen from. And electrolysis is not a perfect system either. You can't just put a couple of volts differential and have 100% of your water transferred into hydrogen and oxygen. Electrolysis devices kind of crap out at a certain percentage, something like, you know, after about 30 or 40 or 50% conversion, they stop working. So again, the realities of physics kind of get in the way of all this kind of dream talk.
I love you being this way, keep it this way, because then the whole discussion makes the sense. So your major value, Dr. Freud, is your criticism. I love it. So I'm going to give you the example. So let's say you have a spark, and if you measure the energy of spark, it's very small. But then when you light a fuel, light a fire, from that point, that spark is no longer important. Now the fire comes from the wood or from the fuel there. So once you start the engine and you light up the fuel, now you're starting the process which gives the energy to the battery. For comparison, a typical car engine runs only closer to 20% thermal efficiency. And 80% of that energy released in combustion is lost as a waste heat. But the best star streetcar engines get close to maybe, let's say, 40%. Or you might get even 50% for a Formula One engine, built out whatever, Yeti Deep, Unicorn Drum Draft. 60% is the extraordinary climb, and I agree with you. The extraordinary climb demand extraordinary proof, and that's what astronauts have to do. But what they say is logic. If you can have a fire from the spark, you can use another fuel to produce energy. Back to you.
Yes, but that's obscuring things. The energy you're using is hydrogen. And the way you're getting hydrogen is with a battery causing electrolysis. And unfortunately, what these three people are suggesting is that you can then feed back the kinetic energy of the motor to a generator to recharge the battery, except that the torque of generators is dependent upon the load that they're supplying the power to. And since you want to recharge your battery, that's a strong load, so that's a high torque. So now, are you either moving some vehicle or are you charging a battery? If you're only charging a battery, you're still going to run out of things because there's a lot of thermal loss, but it'll take you a little bit longer. If you have it hooked up to a wheel as part of a vehicle, then it's going to stop almost immediately. Again, this is unfortunately a case of someone taking an extension cord and plugging into it back into itself and assuming that it will kind of feed back the current and such, and it doesn't. So all of these interactions going from generator to battery, battery to electrolysis device to hydrogen engine, all introduce their own losses. So when you add them all up, you don't get perpetual motions. You still don't. Yes, David?
How are you, sir? I hope you're having a fantastic night.
Well, I just got my vaccines yesterday, so I'm a little bit wobbly, but I'll get over it.
Sir, well, I hope you feel better soon.
I will. It's just a post-vaccine effect. I took it yesterday afternoon. So it's not uncommon to have a little bit of effect about 24 hours after. But, you know, by tomorrow I should be fine.
Yes, I know what you mean. And, yes, I've had the experience myself.
Yeah, at the top of the TechNet, I advised certainly people in the higher age group to strongly consider taking their COVID booster vaccine for this winter.
QSO, I haven't decided yet, and I'll ask my doctor when I have my physical.
Okay, I'm sure he will probably think that it's a good idea, but do that.
QSO. I hope the COVID will go away. You know, people tell me that the COVID is here to stay, but there's certain things that you can do about it.
Well, there's a bunch of problems. You know, it's like influenza, you know. I mean, we had that big influenza back in 1918, and we're still taking booster vaccines for that. It's able to mutate its protein coat, those spike proteins, and there's enough people who didn't get vaccinated to kind of give it enough of a population to kind of mutate through the population and shift a little this way, that way, making it necessary to reformulate the messenger RNA vaccines because the proteins are not identical to the original ones back in the bad old days of the novel COVID.
QSO. Well, you know, there are people who believe the whole thing is, it's fake, you know. And they believe by doing other things, they'll be protected. So, you know, that also is one opinion that people have, you know. They say that the immune boost is more effective than the actual vaccine. And also, there are people that say that the vaccine can cause all kinds of long-term problems.
Well, Dan, there are also people who will tell you that the Earth is flat. I don't think that's any particular reason to believe that either. You look at who's saying what and when, and generally the people saying all the weird things are weird people. And there's a good reason why they're saying weird things.
QSO. Yeah, I'll ask my doctor. I have a conversation with him coming up in about a month or so. So, you know, if he can convince me to take it, then I probably will.
Okay, like I said before, we talked about this, I think, last week. It's always good to ask your physician his opinion about medical advice. He's the one who went to school. He's the one who hopefully knows more about it than people who didn't go to school. So, yes, avail yourself of his wisdom.
insurance company for the coverage.
Yes, yes, but unfortunately a lot of people are afraid of doctors and they don't like to go to doctors, and so they rationalize aches and pains and bits and pieces of them falling off until it might be too late. I mean, unfortunately, even Steve Jobs was guilty of that. He died of pancreatic cancer, which is a terrible form of cancer. His form of cancer, though, would have been amenable to aggressive treatment if he had sought it out early, but instead he tried naturopathic stuff, and by the time he gave up on that and actually went to a real doctor, it was a little too late to do anything, and he passed away. So even, you know, clever guys, wealthy guys, make mistakes.
I would like to finish.
Sir, I'd like to stay out of trouble. I'll pass this over to Wesley. He wants to talk.
Yes, indeed. Wesley, like I said before, I mean, I don't want to bust your balloon, but basically this is a perpetual motion machine, in theory. You can't feed it back on itself. It has non-zero losses that would undermine its entire functioning.
Perpetual motion doesn't exist. So I'm not saying that it works. I'm not saying that it doesn't work. As I said at the beginning of, something may sound as hard to believe it, but I have another part of questions, actually one question to you. They claim, so let's say it works, so that they have two engines. One has the tank, one doesn't have a tank. So let's say it works, for the sake of the discussion. Two wealthy billion dollars companies want to do something. And let's say it works. Let me jump. Okay. They claim that there is no pollution. It's a clean water. And for me, it's a lie. Any type of high temperature combustion, diesel, gasoline, natural gas, hydrogen, produce nitrite oxides, which include nitric oxide NO and nitric dioxide NO2, both hazardous air pollutants, because hydrogen burns at higher temperatures than the natural gas. The combustion of the pure hydrogen may result in a higher level of oxides, nitrous oxide emissions. True or false?
But there are ways around it. That's all that this really engine supposedly does, is it sets things up so that it has a lower temperature function. But, you know, depending upon what the burn temperature for the hydrogen and oxygen combustion is, you know, it depends.
Hey, Roy, let me know when you want to talk about sound waves.
Okay, I mean, we should kind of be wrapped up soon with Wesley. He only has one major question, so when we finish up, it should be about 5-10 minutes, maybe 15. I remember from last week, I promised you, we'll talk about sound waves.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your time and the chance for me talking about that technology. We'll see the time will show. We're going to have an engine that is as heavy as a small child. Could you drive our vehicles or eventually airplanes or eventually wreckers or whatsoever. Thank you very much, and to next year.
So, Wesley, are you going to invest in the company? Because the website is, I think, looking for more investors. I think someone was jamming you or your microphone fell half off because I couldn't hear anything you said.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, I said I appreciate you taking one opinion. I'm taking always the opposite one. We make a conversation this way, we can have a constructive communication. If we talk the same, then it's going to be communism. I run out from the communism. Back to you.
Okay, I agree with you. It's always to have interesting to discuss different viewpoints on a subject, so that's very good. And I thank you, as always, for your participation. David, you want to talk sound waves?
QSL. Sound waves. Start with an acoustic instrument like a guitar, a voice, a stand-up bass, a saxophone, a xylophone. You know, these instruments make a sound that make people feel really good, much more so than recorded sound or sound that comes from a PA system or a guitar amplifier. What do you have to say about that? Say that if there's something about the quality of the sound that makes such a big difference.
Well, I mean, you know, if you want to be picky, anything that produces sound, you know, produces sound. A rock hitting the ground produces sound waves. What you're talking about is reproduced sound waves and naturally occurring sound waves. And as good as technology improves, it's probably never going to get to the point where it is exactly the same, because naturally occurring sound waves are phenomena of the musical instruments and their relationship in space. And most reproduced sound waves come from either one, two, or more than two sound-producing speaking systems arranged in different patterns. So to be able to make those artificial reproduced sound waves have the same timbre and other qualities as they get inside your ear and get figured out by your brain is a big problem. And a lot of brilliant people have worked a lot of years on trying to reproduce the natural sounds, you know, Dolby and other people, but they'll probably always be tweaking the algorithms, in my humble opinion. But, you know, reproduced sound is pretty decent these days, although a lot of people have terrible ears and they couldn't hear the difference between a good reproduction and a terrible reproduction of natural sounds.
Well, digital audio, in so many ways they try to mimic the analog sound. If you listen to an iPhone 15, an Apple iPhone 15, the quality of the sound is quite amazing, you know, for compressed digital audio, especially MP3s and AAC files, and the streaming of the audio also sounds quite exceptional.
Yeah, but you don't just need to have lossy, compressible music. There are formats that have non-lossy compression, so they decompress to the same exact data. It's only digital data versus analog. But, you know, you could say sort of the same thing about analog music is not the same as natural music. You know, if you listen to a symphony in person, even a good record of it is not the same thing.
QSL. But, you know, what I'm saying is that, you know, we have MP3s and AAC files, which are compressed digital audio. And I guess what the manufacturer is aiming for is they try to make all the hardware and software to make these deficient files sound really good, where eventually that takes the place of much bigger files and much more resolute files.
Well, there are people out there, usually musicians who made a lot of money in the music industry, who invested in technology to have lossless, high bit rate musical reproduction, and people had to pay a premium, and they didn't want to pay the premium, so the business went out of business. So, unfortunately, it takes two sides. Like I said before, unfortunately, if you randomly take 100 people off the street, I would be willing to bet you that 75 of them could not tell the difference between a decent MP3 and, say, an OGG that's lossless. It's just a lot of people either don't have trained ears or who have lousy ears. A lot of people, as we get older, we lose more and more of our high frequency range. When you're a kid, you can hear up to 20,000 hertz. My headphones are designed, spec'd for 20,000 hertz. I can't hear anything past 10,000 hertz these days.
I agree with you there, but I will say that they will know the difference if they're sitting in front of a live jazz band, or if they're sitting in front of a live orchestra, or they're sitting in front of an acoustic set, you know, for rock music. You know, to play an acoustic instrument and to get the sound, you know, there's something really great about that. I don't know what it is, you know. And my experience is that acoustic, you know, is the way.
Well, you have to understand that our hearing is due to evolution. And evolutionarily, our ancestors never listened to earpieces or loudspeakers. They listened to the sounds of the forest and what have you. So we're kind of designed for naturally occurring acoustic waves, not synthesized and reproduced ones. So, you know, I'll agree with you. But again, that's the case for analog as well. People can tell the difference between a symphony on a vinyl record and a symphony, you know, 10 feet in front of them. So, you know, it's just the nature of the complex set of circumstances that real-life acoustic musical instruments produce that a loudspeaker or two or three or four don't.
KG2RY. Yeah. Well, you know, my father is a hi-fi enthusiast, and he believes that some records sound great, some records that don't sound so great, depending on the engineering and the quality of sound. Varies from record to record. And also CDs, you know, that some of them sound better than records, and some of them, they sound terrible. And I guess, how to say, I'm trying to think of the word, you know, it's subjective, and maybe even if there was a rock band playing acoustic, didn't sound good. I don't know.
Well, you know, I mean, ultimately, recording engineers can make or break a good recording, both analog or digital. When digital first came out, the recording engineers didn't really know how to work with it, and I guess they basically worked with it the same way they worked with analog, and it came out originally very harsh and very uncomfortable to listen to. And some of the very early CDs you can pick up some places, and you can listen to the terrible recording. But they learned how to adjust their methods to suit their technology. I mean, the same thing happened with high-definition television. When high-definition television was shiny and new, recording studios didn't really know that they couldn't get away with things that they had gotten away with in the good old days of NTSC. And so they had to change filters and cameras and makeups and all kinds of things, because there was a lot of things that they had gotten lazy and learned to get around in the old lower resolution days that they couldn't fake out for the high resolution. So every time the technology makes the shift, the people in charge of kind of tweaking and adjusting the recordings have to learn their lessons. So the same thing happened with digital and analog. I know there's a lot of people who love their vinyl. I still remember vinyl clicking and jumping and making a static, and how I had to kind of wipe the dust off of it repeatedly and pray to the gods of vinyl. And it's just easier with digital. There's no clicks, there's no pops, there's no skips anymore.
Take my CDs and I put them into my iTunes, and you know, the ones I want to listen to, and that works pretty good for me. You know, throughout the years there was this rock band called the Grateful Dead. The Grateful Dead, they always had an excellent recording. Their sound engineers were exceptional. You know, when they played concerts and the wall of sound and all of that, when they played concerts, the engineers allowed people to connect their tape recorders into the soundboard, you know, so they could learn how to create recordings like that.
Well, Grateful Dead was always a little on the subversive side, and wasn't as interested in making a profit as a lot of the other bands. A lot of other bands wouldn't let the people do that, you know, because they would figure that somehow it would have repercussions to their royalty checks and such. So, yeah, it's nice when people kind of give their listeners and their fans a break that way.
You know, and their recordings, the records were perfect. The records were so amazing. I remember, you know, and it was worth having a hi-fi stereo just to play those records.
Well, I mean, there were bands and there were performers who were professionals and were very, very, very into what the sound reproduction would sound like, and they would spend as much time as it needed to be spent to make it. And I'm sure there were somewhat lackluster bands that were just getting the fee and just wanted to make it the shortest event possible. But, you know, I mean, a good performer, a good craftsman takes their time to do the very, very best. And, you know, it's a pleasure to listen to those people's work. It's just a shame that, unfortunately, the other guys who just kind of throw crap together and just make do are mixed into the blend.
I have one question unrelated to sound waves. Do you ever operate on 12 meters?
No, I was chatting with someone on 10 meters today about how I don't really have an antenna that tunes at 12. I probably could kind of use my antenna tuner, because it's my antenna tunes at 10 and probably could tune at 11. So I could probably tune at 12, but I turned to 12 today, and for whatever reason, there was nothing there. 17 had two active conversations going on, but 12 was just noise in the background.
Yeah, I have a second radio. My antenna, it is resonant on 10, 15, 20, and 40. But when I use the LDG 80100 Pro 2 antenna tuner, I'm able to tune up on 17 and 12 and make contacts there. You know, I was told that the antenna, you know, is somewhat resonant on 17 and 12, but not completely.
Okay, well, it depends on what you have. You know, if you have a good enough antenna tuner, as I've mentioned before, antenna tuners sometimes can tune doorknobs. The only problem is the attenuation loss being reflected back and forth on the transmission line is going to lower the efficiency of the signal that you're going to push out. But, you know, if propagation conditions are keen and you just need a few watts to get there,